Chapter 55. Lorna. The apartment looks bare without all of Alberto's things. Lorna walks around it, forlornly. More years of her life wasted with the wrong man. Her heart feels heavy, but she knows it's not for him. It's for the daughter and son-in-law she's left behind in England. She's had enough of flitting from country to country and from man to man. She wants to be near Safi and the baby when he or she arrives. Put down roots for once. Theo and Jen flash into her mind. A brother she never knew she had. She wants a relationship with them too, despite the dark secrets that lurk in the past. And more than anything, she wants to make it up to Safi for not always being there when she was a kid. Her daughter's words occasionally worm their way into her mind when she's going about her day. She could rent a little place somewhere on the Bristol Channel so she's not too far away from Safi. Yes, she resolves, as she perches on the edge of her bed and kicks off her boots. Yes, she'll do it. First thing tomorrow, she'll put the plan into motion. The lease here is a rolling one. She can leave more or less straight away. She's suddenly energized at the thought. She takes out the photograph of Daphne and Rose, standing in front of the cottage with their flared jeans and tank tops. Daphne, the taller of the two, has her arm slung around Rose's shoulders. Safi had given it to her before she left. She can't stop staring at it, at her real mother's beautiful face, searching for some resemblance. Ever since they found out the truth, she's been dreaming about her, the pretty, petite woman with the golden brown hair and the chocolate eyes, eyes like hers and Safi's. Snapshots of a life come to her in her subconscious when she's asleep. Walks through the woods holding her real mother's hand, standing in the village square listening to Christmas carols and drinking hot cocoa. She doesn't know if they're memories or her brain imagining scenarios she wishes were true. The sadness she'd felt in Beggar's Nook when she tried to remember her past. That had been real. She'd been grieving her mother, the real Rose, and hadn't even known it. Earlier, she'd heard from D.S. Barnes. The DNA results were in. He told her the DNA taken from the second body was a close enough match to Lorna's to suggest it was her mother's. It hadn't been a surprise. But Lorna had still burst into tears when she got the news. As she places the photo on the side table, her thoughts are interrupted by her mobile ringing. Safi's name flashes up on screen, and her heart lifts.
Hi, honey. You okay?
Mum!
Safi sounds breathless.
We found it. The evidence that Davies was looking for. The evidence Rose hid in the fireplace. It's...
She gulps.
It's a folder with photographs of naked women.
What do you mean?
It looks like Victor sedated his victims when he was about to perform some kind of procedure on them, and then took photos of them, naked.
Lorna's stomach turns over. Oh my God.
I'm sorry.
Lorna feels dizzy. Have you contacted the police?
We're about to. I also found something else.
Okay.
A letter with your name on it.
A letter from beyond the grave, from her real mother. Lorna stands up and paces her room. Open it.
Are you sure?
Of course, of course. I need to know what it says.
Okay, hold on.
She can hear the rustling sound of the envelope ripping open. And then Safi's back on the line.
Right, well, it's a long letter.
How long?
5 pages or so of A4 paper, front and back.
What does it say?
You want me to read the whole thing?
Yes. No, no, don't do that. It'll take ages. She can hear the flicking of pages.
Shall I read it and then... Oh my God!
Safi gasps. What? What is it?
Rose says here she killed Neil Lewisham. Mum, it's a confession.
Lorna sinks back onto the bed, her legs weak. You're going to have to show it to the police. You need to tell them everything and give them the folder from Victor. Shit. I knew I shouldn't have left. I shouldn't have come back here. She hears Safi's sharp intake of breath.
Oh, Mum.
She says, her voice sad.
I'm only scanning. But in the letter, Rose... It sounds like Victor found her.
Chapter 56. Rose. Bonfire Night, 1980. I decided to hide the folder under the wonky mantelpiece in your bedroom. It had never fitted properly because of the missing bits behind it. I didn't tell Daphne where I put it. Better that nobody knew. Tomorrow, she said, standing at the range, stirring a saucepan full of carrots, potatoes and broccoli. Let's look into renting Skelton Place out, and we can find somewhere to live in Bristol, a big city. It will be easier to blend in. Okay, I agreed. A busy, anonymous street where all the houses looked the same. A place where nobody knew our names. I should have done that from the beginning. I shouldn't have come here, to Beggar's Nook. But tonight, said Daphne, angling her body towards me, wooden spoon in hand. Let's go to the fireworks display and act normally. For Lolly, okay? I nodded. Good, she said. Good. We can do this. It will all be okay. I didn't feel so sure. It was like my world was closing in so that I felt claustrophobic in the village, in the cottage. In the place I'd always felt safest. I think you should wear my old wig, she said suddenly. She was standing in her familiar flamingo pose, the sleeves of her jumper halfway over her hands. Hide that lovely wavy hair of yours. I laughed. My hair was mousy. It didn't exactly stand out. I'll just wear a bobble hat. It'll be cold and dark. So if Victor's there, prowling about, it'll be hard for him to recognise me. She surveyed me, a frown creasing her brow. What? I asked, suddenly feeling self-conscious. Nothing. She shook her head. He's just, you're stronger than you think, Rose Grey. I don't know, you are, she said, her voice softer now. The way you escaped, Victor. Really? I'm impressed. She blew me a kiss and turned back to her cooking. There was a feeling of anticipation in the air as the three of us made our way to the village that evening. You were walking between us, as usual, holding each of our hands, while Daphne chatted away to you about toffee apples on sticks. I glanced over your head at Daphne. She looked carefree and happy, not worried at all. Whereas my stomach felt like the inside of a washing machine. And every time I heard a shout of laughter or a dog barking, I'd flinch. It wasn't just Victor I was worried about. It was the thought of starting a new life away from the village with all its familiarity. I was beginning to doubt moving to Bristol. It was something Daphne had always wanted to do. I think she was worried that if we stayed here, someone would eventually come looking for Neil, and find out who she really was. But I'd never liked big cities, even though I grew up in London. But Daphne was right about one thing. If Victor had found me, we had no choice but to move away. The firework display was being held in a field near the farm where Daphne worked. It was a bit of a trek, for you especially. But you didn't complain. You were too excited at the prospect of sugary food and fireworks. We followed the throng of people through the village square, over the bridge, and towards the farm. At work yesterday, Sean told me there's going to be hot dogs and a bonfire, said Daphne to you. You squealed in excitement and clutched our hands tighter. You were too young last year to go to any display. Sean again. Daphne talked about him a lot. He lived in Chippenham and travelled in every day. She said she saw him as a younger brother, but I worried he wasn't a good influence on her. Ever since he started at the farm, she'd been bringing more items home. Things I wasn't sure Mick would be very happy about if he knew. She was allowed friends, of course. I never wanted to be a controlling partner. But I couldn't help my unease. It felt safer to keep our circle as small as we could. And even though I'd never met Sean, I'd already made up my mind that I didn't trust him. It's quite crowded, I said, trying to keep the anxiety from my voice. I think neighbouring villages might have got tickets too, she said. I bristled. I couldn't enjoy myself. I watched Daphne lead you around the field, going from one stall to another, while I hovered behind, like a bouncer on high alert, still terrified that Victor might be looking for me. It was dark, with a fine drizzle in the air. I could see your pink and red bobble wobbling as you followed Daphne around, your hand tightly in hers. Make sure you don't let go of her hand, I said to Daphne. I must have sounded stern, because Daphne's eyes widened in surprise and hurt, as she said that, yes, of course she would. I'd guard this child with my life, she said. I lurked behind you both when you stopped at the toffee apple stall. Shouldn't she have a hot dog first? I said, leaning over. But Daphne was already placing the toffee apple in your eager hand. Sorry, she mouthed over her shoulder, not looking sorry at all. I felt too wound up to eat, so wasn't bothered when Daphne bypassed the hot dog stand, snaking her way through the crowd with you to the front. The huge bonfire was already lit, the smoke billowing and dispersing into the damp night. People jostled next to us, clutching polystyrene cups, and I could hear the faint tinny music coming from one of the nearby stalls. You leapt up and down in front of us, your excitement palpable, until I had to put my hands on your shoulders to stop you. You'll wear yourself out. I tried to laugh, but it stuck in my throat. Daphne leant into me and whispered in my ear, Shall I get us a drink? A hot chocolate or something? It's freezing, and we might be waiting a while. I stood on tiptoe to peer around anxiously. I don't know. You might lose us. I'll find you, don't worry, she said. And then she was gone, moving effortlessly through the crowds in her patched velvet coat and her crocheted beret. And I was reminded of the night, nearly a year ago, when I'd first spotted her in the square, and my heart had sung. I turned back to you. Daffy's just going to get a drink, I said, not sure if I was trying to reassure you or myself. I held your hand tightly. No, you said, letting go. Don't want. No, hold my hand, I snapped. and then instantly felt guilty. Please, Lolly, I don't want you to get lost. You turned away from me to continue eating your toffee apple, but you let me hold your hand. Where was Daphne? She was taking too long. I wished we were at home, safe in the cottage. Hello, hello, said a voice beside me. It was Melissa, clutching a flask. Isn't this exciting? And what a great turnout. I said, glancing over her shoulder to see if I could spot Daphne. Then I turned back to Melissa with an idea. Actually, I'm glad I bumped into you. This is going to sound strange. I lowered my voice and angled my body away from you so that you couldn't hear. But the man who came into the cafe looking for me, I'm worried it's someone I used to know. Someone I escaped from. Oh, lovey, I'm sorry, I didn't realise. I held up my hand. I needed to get this out before I changed my mind. I've done something stupid, really stupid. My life, I said, could be in. I mouthed the next word so that you couldn't hear. Danger. Melissa's eyebrows shot up. What do you mean? If something happens to me... Why, nothing's going to happen to you, dear. Don't be silly. Listen, please. If something did, the evidence is in the fireplace. Can you remember that? It's very, very important. She looked horrified. I will. But I'm worried for you. Is there someone I can call? The police? No, I almost shouted. You turned, and I smiled at you. When you looked back to the bonfire, I said, in a hushed tone, No, please, no police. I'm sure it's fine, but just in case. She threw me a look of concern, but agreed. Oh, there's Maureen. Sorry, lovey, I need to go. She turned away from me, probably with relief that she'd found someone more normal to talk to. I craned my neck to see if I could spot Daphne. She was taking ages with the drinks. And then I spotted her, over by the hot dog stand, talking to someone. My heart started racing. It looked like a man, tall, dark. Was it Victor? No, of course it wasn't. This man looked younger, dressed in wellies and a wax jacket. Daphne was smiling, and so was he from the way he was throwing his head back and touching her arm. Jealousy shot through me. Were they flirting?
Mummy, when is it going to start?
I turned my attention back to you, unease growing in my gut like bacteria. Soon, sweetheart. Really soon.
I feel sick.
You thrust the half-eaten toffee apple into my hand. Not surprised, I said, trying to keep my voice light.
Oh, look. Look, it's starting.
You were distracted by the rocket that ripped through the sky and exploded over our heads in rays of pinks and purples. And then I felt a hand on my shoulder. I jumped, but it was only Daphne. She pressed her cold cheek against mine. Sorry, she said. Here. She handed me a polystyrene cup, and I dropped the toffee apple on the ground, stifling the guilt I felt at littering, so that I could take it and still hold your hand. Who are you talking to? She frowned. No one. Why? I saw you. With a man. A man? She looked confused for a few moments before she apparently twigged. Oh, yes, that was Sean. What was he doing here? He came all the way from Chippenham. She shrugged, like it was no big deal. It crossed my mind that she hadn't brought him over to introduce us. Did he even know about me? About us? I told myself I was being silly. Of course she would have told him. Unless he thinks she's my lodger. And nothing more. She giggled. I think he fancies me a little bit. But it comes in handy. I stared at her in shock. What had happened to all her feminist principles? To the we don't need men conversations we frequently had? What? She laughed, sipping her drink. He helps me carry the heavy stuff. God, Daphne. I turned away from her. Her next words were drowned in the explosion of fireworks, and I bent down so that I was on your level. I didn't want to look at Daphne. You were watching intently, your mouth open in surprise as a banger burst into a riot of gold and yellow, but you covered your ears with your hands. Are they too loud? You shook your head. Pretty! I ignored Daphne for the rest of the show, not even sure why I was so cross with her. Was I jealous that she was flirting with a man? Or was it because she seemed so totally unconcerned that Victor might be here and that I could be in danger? When she was worried about Neil, I was there for her. I killed for her. And in return, she was acting like my situation was just one big joke. When it had finished, I clutched your hand and turned, expecting Daphne to be behind us. But she had gone. Chapter 57. Rose. Bonfire night, 1980. I scanned the field for Daphne. She couldn't have gone far. I'd obviously upset her with my frostiness. We rarely argued. We never really had much to argue about, living in our safe little house with you. Even with the spectre of Neil hanging over us. But now that Victor was potentially in the area, everything had turned in on itself. I was once again on full alert.
Mummy, tired,
you complained, as I frog-marched you across the field. People were dispersing, and we wove in and out of them, searching for Daphne, but also hyper-aware of Victor. You were still slurping at your hot chocolate, although my cup was empty. Sorry, Annie, but we need to get home as quickly as we can, I said, trying to hide the fear in my voice. Why had Daphne gone off and left us when she knew I was scared about Victor? As we attempted to leave the field, there was a bottleneck, as everyone tried to get through the gate at the same time, and we had no choice but to stop and wait. I glanced around anxiously. We were penned in on all sides by people who stamped their feet impatiently and complained loudly about the holdup. I studied every male face in case it was Victor's, and I clutched your hand tightly. Don't let go, I said to you, in my sternest voice. Finally, the crowd gave way and swarmed forward, and I breathed a sigh of relief as people scattered, but thankful that there was still enough of a throng to protect us if Victor was there. But as we walked along the high street and up the hill towards Skelton Place, everyone else had melted away, and it was just the two of us.
Bit scared, Mummy,
you said, gripping my hand tightly. And my heart broke. You must have sensed my fear, because you were never normally scared. You looked around at the high hedges and the woods that encompassed us with wide, terrified eyes. Somewhere far away, an owl hooted.
It looks later than it is because the moon is hiding behind the clouds tonight, I said, trying to keep my voice jolly. It's only 8 o'clock.
I'm tired.
We're nearly home. Not far now. Just up the hill a bit. What about a piggyback? He nodded eagerly, and I bent down to allow you to climb up. You wrapped your little arms around my neck, and I grabbed your ankles.
Giddy up,
I said, trying to pretend to be a horse as I jogged up the hill, even though I thought my legs would buckle from exhaustion. Fear that Victor might suddenly appear from behind a bush gave me the adrenaline to keep going.
Where's Daffy?
You asked, as the cottage came into view. My heart sank when I could see there were no lights on. We lost her, I said, my voice sounding small in the darkness. But don't worry, she won't be far behind. He jumped off my back as I opened the front door. The cottage was cold and dark and empty. I felt uneasy, as if someone was about to jump out at me. I turned on the light in the hallway. Daphne's coat wasn't hanging up. Where was she? An image of her and Sean flashed through my mind, and I pushed it away. I turned on all the lights downstairs. The windows were opaque. Was someone out there? Looking in. I shivered. A firework exploded overhead, making me jolt.
Come on, Lolly. Let's get you to bed, I said, taking your hand and leading you upstairs.
I tucked you up in bed and read you a story, but you fell asleep before it was finished. And then I kissed your forehead and stroked your lovely curly hair away from your face. Another noise outside made me jump. It didn't sound like a firework this time. It was coming from the garden. Carefully, I got up from your bed and went to the window, pulling aside your pink gingham curtains. I froze with fright. There was a man on my lawn looking up at the house. It was Victor.
Chapter 58. Theo. Okay, says Theo into the phone, glancing across at Jen, who's pushed her sunglasses onto her hair and has raised her eyebrows questioningly. She's lying on the sun lounger in their little garden, her bare legs stretched out in front of her. So, he's been charged. He's standing on their patio, the sun beating down on his neck. And, he lowers his voice, he's now been transferred to Wakefield Prison. The French windows that lead into their living dining room are open, and he walks into the shade, worried that the neighbours might hear him. There's already been a storm of press interest.
That's right,
says Ralph, his father's solicitor. He has a deep voice, and Theo imagines he's the kind of person who enjoys a fine wine and nights at the opera, although he's never met the guy.
Because of the seriousness of the charges, he's on remand until the trial. He's been charged with murder as well as sexual assault.
And what about the fertility fraud? Theo still doesn't have all the pieces of the puzzle, just what they've managed to fit together from the evidence Safi found.
Yes, that looks likely to. Although it's more of a grey area. Thanks to all the press interest, a number of women have come forward to the CPS. He's been doing it for years.
They all feel sick. Those women's photos he'd found in his dad's study had been a catalogue, a way for him to remember exactly who he'd artificially inseminated with his own sperm. The other women, the ones in the folder Safi found, he can't bear to think about that. Ralph must mistake Theo's silence for concern because he says,
I'm sorry, it doesn't look good for your father. I've advised manslaughter when it comes to Caroline, as he says he didn't mean to kill her, that it was an accident, that they'd argued, she was going to leave him and he'd pushed her in anger. She'd stumbled and fallen down the stairs. If he pleads guilty, there'll be no trial. But do you know what your father's like?
Theo feels a lump in his throat at the sound of his mother's name. It hadn't taken his father long to admit his crime. It had surprised Theo. He believed his dad would go to his grave protesting his innocence, but it seems that the evidence had been too much for him to deny. Glenn Davis's testimony of a confession, his alibi not holding up to more scrutiny, and a neighbour remembering talking to his father that morning, later than the time he said he'd left for work. What about Rose's murder?
Police are still combing through the evidence on that one. In the letter that Saffron Cutler handed in, Rose writes that she was scared Victor had found her, that she saw him in the garden on bonfire night, but the letter ends after that. We can assume, of course, that he did find her, and that was why she'd never had the chance to finish the letter. But obviously that might not be enough for the court. However, a witness, Melissa Brown, has said that a man fitting Victor's description had been looking for Rose in the days before she disappeared. We'll keep you updated.
And what about Cynthia Parsons?
Not enough evidence to suggest her death wasn't suicide,
he says. At least he's admitted to causing Mum's death, thinks Theo. If only he'd admit to killing Rose, Lorna and Safi would have peace of mind.
He's asked me if you'd like to visit him,
says Ralph, his voice suddenly tentative. He killed my mother, says Theo. I hope he rots in jail. From the garden, Jen is watching him intently, although he's not sure if she can hear what he's saying.
I know, but I had to ask. Anyway, I'll keep in touch and let you know the court date when your father enters his plea.
Thanks for letting me know, Theo says, ending the call. The truth is, he just wants justice. He wants his dad to pay for his crimes. He sinks into a chair, phone still in his hand. A shadow looms over him and he looks up to see Jen standing in the doorway, obscuring the sun. Are you okay, babe? Theo nods. His hands are clammy and he drops his phone onto the table. Jen hops onto his lap and throws her arms around his neck. She smells like coconut sun cream. She doesn't say anything. She doesn't have to. I'm related to that bastard, he says with a sigh. You're nothing like him. You're all your mum. Remember that. And you're not alone. Lorna must be feeling the same way now she knows he's her father. True. Thank goodness for Lorna. He's spoken to her every few days on the phone since she texted him that night to tell him he's her brother. Davis has been charged with a number of crimes too, he says, pulling Jen closer to him. I get the sense he's cut some kind of deal, but he's charged with assault and intimidation, not just to Lorna and Safi, but to other women as well. Fraud, pretending to be an officer of the law, breaking and entering, the list goes on. He feels Jen shudder. Do you think you'll go and see your dad? She asks gently. Even if it's just to ask why he argued with your mum, and if it's true that she was planning to leave him? I never want to see him again, he says with feeling. I hate him, and he'll never be honest. I'll never offer up an explanation as to why he did these things. He'll make excuses, try to blame mum. I'm sorry, I can't even imagine what it must be like. At least he's got Jen, this wonderful woman, Theo thinks, who's always been so supportive and whom he trusts implicitly. I think I might call Lorna, update her on all of this. Sure. She squeezes his shoulder affectionately, then jumps down from his lap. I'm going to carry on with my tanning. She grins at him over her shoulder as she heads back into the garden. Theo watches her go. Her shoulders have already started to turn red. He knows she won't be satisfied until she's sat out there for another hour, at least, despite his warnings of skin cancer. A doctor's son, after all. Later that afternoon, Theo goes to visit his mum's grave. The cemetery is busier than it usually is on a Saturday, which he puts down to the weather. Couples are strolling through the grounds arm in arm, families with young children and buggies. His heart contracts. He wants it so badly for himself and Jen. It's a cruel irony to him that his dad illegally fathered all those children when he, Theo, can't even get his wife pregnant. He wonders why his dad did it. He'd read up on other cases of doctors performing fertility fraud. He'd never heard of it before. A God complex is usually one reason. That sums up his father perfectly. When he reaches his mum's grave, he kneels down to take the old flowers out of the vase and replaces them with the fresh roses. "They got him, Mum," he says, as he arranges the roses in the vase. He's admitted to pushing Hugh, and I think they'll get him for Rose's death too. His voice catches. "I'll never understand what happened that day. I'll never understand him. But I promise, Mum. I promise that if I'm lucky enough to be a dad, I'll be everything he wasn't." He touches the glossy marble tombstone, remembering the last time he'd seen his mum, the weekend before she died. She'd stood on the doorstep, pressing a bag of homemade cottage pies and lasagnas into his hands. She was the one who'd made him want to become a chef. She'd given him a huge hug, almost as if she knew it would be the last. And then she'd stood waving until he'd reversed out of the driveway, her smile hiding the pain she must have been feeling. "I'm sorry," he says, a lump forming in his throat. "I'm sorry I never knew what he was capable of. I'm sorry I couldn't save you."
Chapter 59. Daphne. August 2018. Two women come and visit me today. They have dark, curly hair, although one is older than the other. The younger one is wearing denim dungarees and looks like she might be pregnant. The older of the two is in an orange sundress. They are both beautiful. But all young women are beautiful to me, with their youth and their agility and their hips that don't ache when they walk. "Gran," says the younger one, sitting beside my bed. "I've been in bed a lot lately. My body doesn't feel strong, but I don't know why." I cough, and the younger one's face crumples with worry. She's chewing her bottom lip. The older woman looks hostile. She reminds me of someone. The expression she's pulling, the disappointment in her eyes. She reminds me of Rose. "It's Safi," says the pregnant one. Safi. Safi. The name rings a bell. She's calling me Gran. She must be my granddaughter. The other has to be her mother. They look so alike. But I've never had children. I know that. I'd remember that. The younger one is crying. I don't know why. Tears are slipping down her face and falling onto the denim trouser legs, creating little dark splodges. "Who are your tears for, my dear?" I long to ask her. But my mouth won't move. The words won't come. The older woman stands behind this Safi and squeezes her shoulders. "Mum," she says, looking at me. "It's Lorna. Lolly." "Lolly. Of course it's Lolly. My Lolly. My love." "I wish you could remember," she says softly. "I wish you could remember what happened to Rose, why you took her name." "Of course I remember. To keep you safe," I suddenly say, and their eyes widen in surprise. My voice is croaky. I sound like an old woman. The hands folded over my sheets are wrinkled and veiny. I am an old woman. Of course I am. Why do I keep forgetting that? Lolly comes around the other side of the bed and places her hands over mine.
I want to forgive you so much, she says. Her hands feel warm on top of my cold ones. Especially now. We'll never really know what happened that night, she says to me. I stare back at her. I'm not completely sure which night she's referring to. I close my eyes. It hurts to keep them open. My chest aches, and so do my lungs. I can hear their voices, although they sound very far away. But they're talking about Skelton Place and Rose. My Rose. I realise they're talking about an upcoming court case and Victor Carmichael. They're talking about the night Rose died. And despite the pain in my chest and the ache in my lungs, I begin to talk. I could feel Rose slipping away from me. It was the same feeling I had when I was a kid, when I was Jean. Susan pulled away from me too, and I knew the same thing was happening with Rose. It began after she killed Neil, looking back. She wasn't a murderer. She didn't put the bad things she had done in a box in the deep basement of her mind, not to be looked over, dwelt on, again. Not like I did. It was a gift. It helped me move on. But Rose couldn't do that. Rose needed to believe she was a good person, that she was kind, that she'd go to heaven one day. I loved that about her, that innocence. It was refreshing after what I'd come from. But sometimes it could also be unbelievably annoying. She expected too much from people. Nobody was all good or all bad, but Rose was very black and white. And I could tell, after she found out who I really was, she began to re-examine her feelings for me. She got past it because she had killed too. But she could console herself that she'd done it out of loyalty and love, out of protection and self-defense. Mine had been out of anger and fear, and that deep-rooted sense of abandonment. I don't know what I thought I was trying to achieve by flirting with Sean. I never fancied him for a second, but I wanted to make Rose jealous, I suppose. To make her realise she loved me. She needed me. And then, at the fireworks display, I noticed the way she looked at me. It was cold, detached, as though she'd had enough of me. I was so hurt by it that I couldn't stand to be near her. So I walked away, got lost in the crowd. When she noticed I was gone, she didn't even seem that concerned. She just took Lolly's hand and moved through the crowds towards home. I walked around the village for a bit, trying to gather my thoughts, hoping that Rose would miss me, would realise that we were right for each other. I hoped by the time I got back, she'd be so scared about Victor. She'd agree we needed to leave together. A new life away from there. When I eventually returned, Rose was pacing the little kitchen, her face white. She had a knife in her hand. She looked like a beautiful but unpredictable horse that was about to rear or bolt. "There you are," she hissed as soon as I walked in. "How could you just leave me like that? You know I was scared with Victor on the prowl." "Rose," I said, gently, walking over to her, my hand out to calm her. "I saw him," she cried. "He was in the garden." She waved the knife around.
I walked over to the kitchen window. The garden was empty, as I'd known it would be. Rose, darling, put the knife down. There's nobody in the garden.
You...
Her jaw was clenched, and she was shaking with fear. Or was it rage? I couldn't tell.
Where did he go? What did you tell him?
We need to leave, Rose, I said instead. Now Victor knows where you are. You know that's not true, she hissed, her eyes flashing. Please, Rose, you're overreacting. It was the worst thing I could have said. She began to accuse me then, of lying, of manipulating her. I should never have trusted you, she said. Joel was right. I was so hurt by her words. But we love each other. This was a mistake, she spat. I have to put Lolly first. You need to leave, you and Sean. There's nothing between me and Sean. What are you talking about? It's over. I want you to leave, now. What? I couldn't believe what she was saying. Are you ending things with us? I don't trust you, she said sadly, but she put the knife down on the worktop with a shaky hand. I'm sorry, Daphne. I love you, but I don't trust you. I think you lie, and... She wiped tears away from her eyes. I can't do this anymore. This couldn't be happening. I thought I'd found the happiness I'd always craved, the family I'd always wanted. To lose Rose was one thing, but to lose Lolly as well. I loved that little girl like she was my own. I'm not letting you leave me, I said, coming over to her and pulling her into my arms. We love each other. I think I need a clean break. Start again. You can't, I wailed. She pulled away from me and swiped at her eyes. Her wavy hair fell over her shoulders. She was shorter than me by about 2 inches, and she looked small and frail in that moment. I was desperate. I needed her to see that she was making the biggest mistake of her life. We know too much about each other, I began. Oh, don't start that, she said. That's not going to wash with me any longer. You can't prove that I killed Neil. Then she started accusing me of all sorts. Manipulation and lies about Sean. She had guessed, my clever, sweet Rose. I'd underestimated her. I knew then that she'd never forgive me, that I'd lost her. It was an accident, just like Susan Wallace's death had been an accident. She pushed past me. She went to walk away. And all I knew was that I couldn't let her go. And I couldn't let her take Lolly. Red flashed in front of my eyes. It happened in one swift movement. I grabbed the kettle, the cast iron one we used for the hob, and swung it against the rear of her lovely head. She fell backwards, as though in a faint, her eyes open in surprise as she collapsed in my arms. Too late, I realised what I'd done. And I held her as she died. I held her, and I cried, and I told her I loved her, over and over again. Because it was true. And apart from Lolly, and then, years later, Safi, I never loved anyone else. When I finished talking, Lolly is staring at me in horror, her mouth hanging open and tears rolling down her cheeks. And I realise I've said it all out loud. I've told this lovely woman, this amazing person, whom I love like my own daughter, that I killed her real mother. Safi, my kind, thoughtful granddaughter, is holding my hand. And despite everything I've just told her, she doesn't let go. I can see Rose in her, the same guile and innocence and faith. And I hope that I haven't destroyed that in this sweet child. I'm sorry, I say, my mind painfully, awfully lucid in this moment. Because the truth of it is, my mind has always been more lucid than I gave them reason to believe. Don't get me wrong, I have dementia. My brain is foggy and forgetful, and I don't recognise people I know, people I love. But when I do have those clear, perfectly sharp moments, I remember a lot more about the past, about what I've done, than any of them have ever given me credit for. And now they know. They know the truth. My truth. Before I slip further into myself. Because one day, I won't have control over how I reveal it. And I wanted them to know I'm not a cold-hearted killer. I'm not a psychopath. That the judge was wrong about me all those years ago. I was a good mother and grandmother. And that, despite everything, I loved Rose. I really, really did. Chapter 60, Epilogue. 1 year later. Lorna observes her family, gathered in the garden of 9 Skelton Place. The bifold doors to the new kitchen are flung open, and Snowy sits just inside, in the shade, enjoying the cold of the new slate tiles, his head resting on his paws. Sometimes, especially on hot summer days like today, it's hard to believe what went on here nearly 40 years ago. Occasionally, when she closes her eyes at night, she has visions of Daphne kneeling in the garden, prising up the patio slabs to bury Rose alongside Neil. Sometimes it's so sharp that she wonders if it's a repressed memory and that she had witnessed it. It's something she's working on with Felicity, her psychiatrist. No wonder Daphne never sold the cottage, and why it stood empty for a while before she rented it out. She couldn't risk anyone finding the bodies. But she won't think of that today. Because today, the scene in the garden is a happy one. The sun is high in the cloudless sky, and there, on the lawn, fussing over their 9-month-old daughter, Freya, are Safi and Tom. Tom's laid out her colourful playmat on the grass, and she sits, like the queen she's become to them all, in her little yellow dress, surrounded with stuffed toys and teething rings. Safi is lying beside her, propped up by her elbow. Lorna knows Safi has surprised herself by how much she loves her little girl. And it's given her a new confidence, a bloom that Lorna is proud to witness. Next to them on 2 sun loungers, smiling indulgently, are Theo and a pregnant Jen. They got lucky on their first round of IVF, and Jen is due in 8 weeks' time. It's worked out well for them all, she thinks, glancing around, a cold glass of Pimm's in her hand. And she's pleased for them. She really is. She's happy to be living in England, has, for once in her life, put down roots in Portishead. She has even bought her own apartment overlooking the marina, in the same block as the flat she rented when she first moved back from Spain. And sometimes, especially on a hot day, it feels like she's abroad, a homeowner at last. And she's closer to Safi than she's ever been. After Safi gave birth, they had a real heart-to-heart. "I love her so much, it hurts," Safi had said, holding her newborn daughter in her arms in her hospital bed. She'd stared at Lorna with tears in her eyes. "I'm sorry. I'm so sorry for the things I said, doubting you. You're the best mum in the world, and now I know the love I feel for Freya. God, I'd die for her. Like I'd die for you." And they'd smiled at each other over Freya's tufty hair. A smile of understanding, mother to mother. They meet at least once a week. Sometimes Safi drives over to Portishead, or Lorna will come to the cottage. They are close in a way that Lorna never was with Daphne. There was always a gulf between them that she could never explain. But now she knows why. On some unconscious level, she must have known that Daphne was an imposter. She has been seeing Felicity once a fortnight, and she's been great at helping Lorna work through her issues, mainly her worry about being the child of two murderers, not that she puts Rose and Victor in the same bracket. And Felicity has made her see she doesn't have a dark heart, that it's not genetic. But she has made Lorna understand that she does run away from her problems, and she does have trouble forging romantic relationships. So that's something she's going to work on in the future. There is still a spark between her and Ewan. He's even been to stay with her in her new place. She doesn't know where it will lead, if anywhere. But she's excited to find out. "So," says Theo, lifting his glass. Tom is standing at the barbecue in the corner, a pair of tongs in his hand, which he raises instead of a glass. "To justice." "To justice," they all echo. "And to the future," says Lorna. And Jen strokes her bump, reaching for Theo's hand. Yesterday they found out that Victor's trial, which had gone on for weeks, had finally come to an end. Victor refused to plead guilty to murder. His plea of manslaughter was turned down. So a trial went ahead, and he was found guilty of the murder of Caroline Carmichael, as well as sexual offences against the women in his folder. 20 different women. He'll be sentenced next month. Lorna knows Theo has never gone to visit him, and she won't either. She has no interest in getting to know her so-called father. There was never enough evidence to charge Victor with Rose's murder. Lorna's heart feels heavy when she thinks of Daphne, lying in her care home bed, admitting to what she had done. It was the first time she really felt the woman she had always thought of as her mother was telling the truth. Neither she nor Safi told the police about Daphne's confession. Maybe they would have, if Victor had ever been charged. She died a few days later. Pneumonia. Safi took her death a lot harder than Lorna did. Safi had found it in her giant heart to forgive Daphne. But Lorna is unsure if she ever can. Daphne robbed Lorna of her real mother a mother she can barely remember. And that breaks her heart. It's still a blank, what she must have gone through after the real Rose suddenly disappeared. She hopes Felicity will be able to unlock some of the memories, however painful. When did she start calling Daphne Mum? She must have cried for her real mother. She must have felt abandoned and confused. And she can never forgive Daphne for that. Even if Daphne did dedicate her life to looking after her, the betrayal is something she'll never get over. She downs her Pimm's and goes into the kitchen to get some water. She can't drink too much. She's driving home after this. She wanders across the kitchen. It's been transformed. Beautiful shaker-style units in a pale grey with white stone worktops. She knows Safi feels guilty. She often says that this house is truly Lorna's. But Lorna is happy for Safi to have it. She's content in her apartment, overlooking the sea. She's found work as a manager of a local boutique hotel in Bristol and has made some new friends. When Daphne died, Lorna inherited the rest of her money. There was more than she'd thought. Money she'd obviously taken from Rose by pretending to be her. It had been enough for her to buy the apartment outright. After Victor's arrest, Lorna did wonder if Safi wanted to stay at Skelton Place. But her daughter said she felt close to Rose, living there. And to honour her, she planted a rose bush at the end of their garden. It started to grow nicely. The top has reached the stone wall. "Are you okay, Mum?" Safi appears beside her, Freya on her hip, sucking the ear of a plastic giraffe. When she sees Lorna, she reaches out her chubby little arms, and Lorna gladly takes her, enjoying the warmth of her granddaughter's little body against hers. "You seem a bit wistful today." Lorna pulls funny faces at Freya, then turns back to her daughter. "I'm just thinking about everything, that's all." Safi walks over to the big American-style fridge to fill Lorna's glass with water. "Why don't you stay tonight? You can have Freya's room, and she can sleep with us. Theo and Jen are staying." "I know, but I'm going to read the letter tonight. I think it's time, don't you? I've been putting it off for long enough." Safi smiles sympathetically and nods. "There's something I need to tell you about that," she says, looking sheepish. The letter. She'd kept it in a drawer, unable to face reading it. She knows it will be upsetting. But now she feels ready. "What's that?" "The last page. I didn't give it to the police at the time. I'm sorry." "You'll see why when you read it. When they returned the letter to me, I made sure to put the last page back before giving it to you. It was before, well, before Gran told us what she did. I was worried it would implicate her. It was wrong of me." Lorna frowns. "I don't understand." "You'll know when you read it," says Safi. "I was just trying to protect Gran. I really loved her." "I know you did, honey. And I did too. I must remember that." They stand together, their arms linked with Freya between them, chewing her toy. "I like to think that Rose is here," says Safi, looking out onto the garden. "The real Rose, looking over us." Lorna smiles at her daughter. Always the romantic. But she hopes it's true all the same. Later, when she's back in her apartment, she pours herself a glass of wine and goes to the balcony. The sun is going down, and she watches as couples and friends, all dressed up, head out for the evening. She can hear the laughter and chatter of people sitting at tables in the restaurant opposite. Yes, this is what she likes, she thinks, as she settles down to read her letter. She likes to feel she's in the middle of things, that around her couples are on their first date or their last, friends are celebrating or reminiscing. She wonders what sort of person she would have become if her real mother had lived. She takes the letter out of the envelope. It's written on sheets of lined A4 paper, yellowing with age, with two horizontal creases. And she stares at it for a minute, at her mother's flowery writing, imagining her sitting down to write it, almost like a diary. She runs her fingertip tenderly over the word lolly, her eyes landing on the first sentence. The village never looked prettier than it did the evening I first met Daphne Hartle. As she reads, she can almost hear her mother's voice, melodious and soothing, as though she's sitting right beside her. And she's reminded of all those bedtime stories that she thought she'd forgotten. And as the sun fades and the stars come out, she sits, entranced in her mother's world, as she learns about her love affair with Daphne, her fear of Victor, and the night of the fireworks, the night she died. And the last page, the final piece of the puzzle that Safi had kept from the police in a misguided attempt to protect the woman she'd always thought of as Gran. When she's finished, she clutches the letter to her chest and stares out at the moon reflecting in the water of the marina, tears on her cheeks, feeling she understands everything at last. So now you know, my darling girl, my lolly. You know everything. My confession, my sins. And if you're reading this, if you found this, along with the evidence of the man I ran from, then I fear it means something bad has happened to me. Because, you see, I no longer trust the woman I love. I found out tonight that she'd manipulated and lied to me in the worst way. And I think she has throughout our relationship. She said she loved me, and in her own twisted way, I think she does. And I have no doubt that she loves you. But tonight, she has sunk to a new low. I fear that nobody walks away from Daphne Hartle with their life. I'm writing this next to your bed as you sleep, your toadstool nightlight glowing in the darkness, your eyelids flickering as you dream. I don't want to leave you, my precious daughter. The thought of being without you hurts so much. And I never would willingly be apart from you. Please know that. Just now, after the fireworks, I thought Victor had found me. But I was wrong. When I felt brave enough to look again out of your bedroom window, I saw that the man on my lawn wasn't Victor at all. I recognised him from the fireworks display. It was Sean. And in that moment, it hit me what a fool I'd been to trust her. He resembled Victor from afar, as Daphne no doubt knew. And I suspect Daphne had told him to stand there to frighten me, to make me think Victor had found me.
I think she also sent him to Melissa's cafe, knowing Melissa would tell me someone was looking for me. Maybe she wanted my fear to bring us closer together, to push me into moving to the city with her. I think she knew I was having doubts about her, that I was on the verge of telling her to leave. And I am, as they say, between a rock and a hard place. Because to involve the police would mean I'd be arrested for the murder of Neil Lewisham and you'd be taken away from me. So, I have decided to stay and fight. And if it goes wrong, if I don't win that fight, I want you to know how much I love you. I love you more than anything in the whole world. I really have tried to be the best mother I could be, to keep you safe. I've made some stupid decisions, but I'm not a bad person. Please believe me. Be strong, my darling, my girl. You are not a product of me or Victor. You are your own person. Be the woman I wish I could have been, my beautiful Lolly. All my love, forever. Mummy. Kiss. This production of The Couple at Number 9, a novel by Claire Douglas, was read by Natalie Buscombe and Kenton Thomas, presented by Harper Paperbacks and Harper Audio. Executive producer, Caitlin Gehring. Text copyright 2021 by Claire Douglas. Production copyright 2022 by Penguin Random House UK. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.